remains of human beings that are currently held in the Harvard museums. Thousands. Most of those remains are likely of Native Americans. They've identified, I believe, 15 that are enslaved Africans. One can again go by university and see the way in which actually the 19th century and 18th century legacy of race science continues to play out on our campuses. And we literally live with the bodies of enslaved people and the bodies of indigenous people who were consumed in the process of building our institutions, not just in the cemeteries, but also in the museums and the libraries. They're there. To come to the recommendations, I think the recommendations include a number of things, including actually building on the Georgetown example, establishing relationships to descendant communities, Native and African and of African descent, memorializing and continuing to do research on Harvard's ties to slavery and the legacy of slavery at Harvard, reaching out to historically Black colleges and universities to establish educational partnerships, creating a legacy of slavery fund, an endowment, the $100 million to fund all of these promises, and then promising some long-term institutional accountability on these questions.
MIT history professor Craig Stephen Wilder long followed the issue of slavery, author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And that does it for our Juneteenth special. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Mary Conlin, and Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
We want abortion, free and on demand!
Right now, we have really great access to abortion care. It could be us next, and quite frankly, in December, when the next case goes in front of the Supreme Court to try to challenge Roe v. Wade, it very well could be. So we need to keep up, we need to speak out so that everybody has access to safe, evidence-based, compassionate, non-judgmental abortion care.
Hi, my name is Claire Rosciotto, and welcome to Roe on the Rocks, a podcast that takes a look at how Oregon, a state with some of the most progressive abortion laws in the nation, will be impacted if Roe is overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, before we get into what is happening here in Oregon, let's go over some context. You've probably heard a lot in the news about national abortion bans, like the one in Texas and the Mississippi U.S. Supreme Court case. So let's review these two issues. The Texas Senate Bill 8, usually called the SB 8 law, bans abortions after 6 weeks and has deputized all American citizens, not just Texans, with the ability to sue and profit off of any one person who assists a Texan in receiving an abortion after 6 weeks. The state of Texas cleverly crafted legislation to skirt around the legal parameters of Roe. Because the state is not enforcing this law, but rather allowing citizens to, then there's Mississippi's 15-week law case, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, that went to the U.S. Supreme Court on December 1st to decide whether or not the state can ban abortion procedures after 15 weeks. This case directly challenges current federal law from the 1973 Roe v. Wade U.S. Supreme Court case decision, which made abortion legal in the United States up to 24 weeks. So here's what that means. If Mississippi's law to prevent abortion after 15 weeks is upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, this will effectively overturn Roe. Now, I'll be getting more into both Texas and Mississippi laws in my next installment of this podcast in spring of 2022. But in this two-episode first installment of Roe on the Rocks, as I said earlier, I'm focusing on what's happening here in Oregon. What you might not know is that while abortion is legal, it is not accessible for everyone, especially for rural and eastern Oregonians who live upwards of 4 hours away from a clinic that provides abortion services. For these individuals, it is far closer to drive to Idaho than several hours to the nearest clinic in Oregon. But here's the catch. Currently, Idaho requires anyone seeking abortion healthcare to wait 24 hours before receiving access, and mandates that all clinics provide informed consent. This includes offering an image of the pregnancy and a pamphlet that describes fetal development and the risks associated with an abortion procedure. So these are the current barriers for many Oregonians and all Idaho residents trying to get access to abortion healthcare. And on top of this, Idaho is one of 12 trigger law states. These are states that have passed laws, like in Texas, to ban all or most abortions. In Idaho, if Roe is overturned, abortion will be restricted to 6 weeks, with exceptions for those whose life is in danger and individuals who have experienced rape and incest. The impact will be so widespread just here in Oregon that, according to reports, overturning Roe will lead to a 234% increase in out-of-state patients seeking access to abortion services here in Oregon, and Eastern Oregonians could see up to a 35% decrease in abortion access because of the longer travel burden to get to these clinics. So in this quest to understand the impact of these abortion bans and barriers, I first spoke with Dr. Jennifer Lincoln, a local OBGYN and author of Let's Talk About Down There. An OBGYN answers all your burning questions without making you feel embarrassed for asking. Dr. Lincoln explains what it means to be pregnant, the different methods of abortion, and whether or not, as I was told growing up, if birth control, such as the IUD, can cause an abortion. Before we continue, I want to mention that this episode discusses rape, incest, sexual violence, and includes detailed explanations of abortion methods. With all of that said, here's my conversation with Portland OBGYN and author, Dr. Jennifer Lincoln. So I was wondering if we can just go through a couple things, and I want to start out with, and this is something that is often mentioned by pro-life activists, which is that birth control, particularly IUDs, are a form of abortifacients. And I was wondering if you could explain how they work, and then, in your opinion, if you believe they're not, which I'm assuming you don't, why they're not abortifacients.
Sure. So I think it's first important to start with what is the definition of pregnancy? Because the medically accepted, even the government accepted, the medically accepted definition of pregnancy is when a fertilized embryo, so sperm plus egg, implants into the uterus. So not that it's in the fallopian tube where fertilization happens, but that it is actually implanted into the uterus. And this is significant because we know that about 25% of 20-25% of recognized pregnancies do end in miscarriage. But that number is actually probably a lot higher because of the pregnancies that have not even been diagnosed. So, that they're what we might call a chemical pregnancy. So fertilized egg, sperm, and then doesn't successfully implant. And so, you're not pregnant. And so I think it's really important you start there, because once you start there, you can say, okay, let's talk about how could birth control cause an abortion. And that's where you can see that they do not, because there is no birth control, whether it's a pill, an IUD, patch, shot, ring, all the oodles of kinds. None of them can disrupt an implanted embryo. They just don't work. So things like birth control or the patch or the pill, they prevent ovulation. So there's not even an egg to get fertilized. That's their primary mechanism. Other forms of birth control, like the IUD, they primarily work by thickening the cervical mucus and making it so that if the sperm even gets past that, which they hardly even can, if they get into the uterus, it's chemically what we consider like a hostile environment, so they can't survive. Now, if you look on the website, or if you look, what I've heard a lot of people say is, no, with the IUDs, they could potentially disrupt a fertilized egg that has not yet implanted in the wall of the uterus, potentially, but that is not their primary mechanism. And based on studies that they've done, they've not actually seen that, but they can't rule it out. So what I tell people, if you are of a religious belief where you believe that pregnancy, life begins when an egg is fertilized, and you really want to make sure that you never, ever, ever, ever disrupt a fertilized egg, even if it's not implanted, then you probably don't want the IUD, because can I tell you 100% no? But if you believe that pregnancy means there's an implanted embryo in the wall of the uterus, then all of these are good, because none of these will work. And that includes what we call Plan B, or the morning after pill. None of them will work after you've even ovulated. So none of these cause abortions. But I have also heard that that belief very commonly from those who do not agree with abortion. And it just shows a basic lack of understanding of the biologic processes here. And I think that's really important to highlight.
For sure. But I want to ask you, what barriers have you seen for those seeking access to safe and legal abortions throughout your time as an OBGYN?
Yeah, what's key here is that I've been lucky to practice my career, the majority of it, here in Portland, Oregon, where we have very progressive, appropriately so, I believe, laws on when it comes to reproductive health. I've not practiced as an independent physician, you know, in Louisiana, where I did my medical school or elsewhere. But I have seen people, and I've known people who have suffered in other places, who have been told that they have to wait, you know, 72 hours, or they have to have an ultrasound and it has to be shown to them, or all of these things that are just not at all medically necessary, but put up truly just to make the process harder so that people, these politicians who are putting these laws out there, can say that they're trying really hard to stop abortion. And I think what's striking is that this year alone, we've already had over 100 abortion restriction laws put in place. So it's getting worse. This is the first time since Roe v. Wade that we've hit triple digits in restriction laws. So while we might be doing okay here in Oregon, that is definitely not the case in other cities and states. And so what we're seeing is people who have no money or don't have enough money and need to travel outside of their state, or they have to take off multiple days of work because of these, they need more than one appointment because that's the law in their state. And it can cost thousands of dollars to travel and get a hotel room, potentially get child care. And what happens is that they either delay their abortion and they have it later, and then they have higher complications the later you go. Abortion is a ridiculously safe procedure. It's safer than childbirth, but when you go from first to second trimester, it increases risk. Or they end up giving birth. And we know that people who with a uterus who are, and this is what I call these, they're forced birthers, because they don't care once the baby's out. When they're forced to give birth, we know that that does terrible things to the mother's mental health, the pregnant person's mental health, and also to the children who are born into a home where they were not prepared for or financially or mentally set up for them. We see in studies that these children do worse developmentally, academically. But again, nobody's talking about that. All they care about is once that fetus exits the womb, then we're all, you know, and that's your problem. There's so many barriers, and they don't want to talk about what happens afterwards, the people, you know, the forced birthers, because that's not really their concern.
Now, something I know that folks who are pro-life that are going to have picked up on, something you said before I asked the last question, is that you said, and I've heard this from medical professionals all the time, that you said that abortion is ridiculously safe. Many folks are going to, you know, gasp at that. Can you talk about why is it so safe? Can you talk about how does it work? And there's different there's different kinds of abortions, of course.
Yeah. So there's like four different kinds. When I break it in my, you know, break it down to explain it. So there's medication abortion, which what you take, you know, a combination of medicines to empty the uterus. We do that up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. There's a vacuum aspiration, which we do up to about 14 weeks, which is using a surgical tube to empty the contents of the uterus. There is something called a D&E, or dilation and evacuation, which we do usually after about 15 weeks, where we use surgical tools to empty the uterus, all, you know, going through the cervix after a couple days of placing something in the cervix to help it dilate. And then there's induction of labor, which is giving medicine to help have a vaginal birth. And those are usually done in those later cases, you know, like I mentioned, like the, you know, somebody, a fetal anomaly or something that's not compatible with life. One of the riskiest things a person can do in their life is to give birth. It's actually, and look where we are in the United States, where our morbidity and mortality rates are higher than in almost all other developed countries. Like, pregnancy is no joke. Pregnancy and postpartum are extremely risky times for people with a person with a uterus. And abortion, when we talk about the complications, the risks associated with them, especially first trimester abortions, the complication risk is less than 1%. It might even be less than 0.5%. I can't remember, but remarkably safe. And when we talk about risks, I'm talking about risks where you might need to come in, you know, for other treatments. So, or needing a repeat procedure, hemorrhage, infection, uterine perforation. And the reason that these are so safe is because these are not complicated procedures, and the earlier we do them, the safer they are. It's why these laws that have been in states where you have to, the physician has to have admitting privileges at a hospital in case there's a complication, or, you know, or the clinics have to have certain measurements. None of them are medically necessary. They're put there just to be roadblocks to make it harder for people to access abortion. I mean, the medications that you take for a medication abortion, I mean, they're safer than Tylenol. But yet there's all these, you know, special hoops you have to jump through to try to prescribe mifepristone. So again, has nothing to do with medicine, has everything to do with control and blockade access.
Got it. And this might be difficult to answer, but is there one out of those mm-hmm. four, or multiple out of the four, that are the most common? What I've read is that when it's in more progressive places like Portland, or, you mm-hmm. know, yeah, Portland, medication often can be the first mm-hmm. point of action.
Yes.
Because it's caught so early.
So that is definitely the most common, like, and has become more common in recent years with the introduction of mifepristone. So what we do is we give two medications, one to stop the growth of the pregnancy, and the second one to cause the uterus to contract. So yes, in terms of safety, that is for sure a very safe one. Not to say that aspiration isn't safe either. They both absolutely are, and both in the first trimester. It's really just about patient preference and also access, what they have access to.
Got it. I grew up Catholic, and I'm not mm-hmm. putting down the church, but I mm-hmm. grew up with very graphic understandings and depictions of what an abortion is, and that it really mm-hmm. opened one way, which sounded very similar to one of the four things that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
If you would, could you go through each of them and talk about what all of those stages look like, and how in some of the cases it really doesn't match what some of us may have been taught. For instance, mm-hmm. a lot of the images,
right, the extreme pictures, yeah,
right. Anyway, if you could go through that.
So it's true that when we do more advanced procedures like a D&E, you know, and when I say more advanced, I mean further along, so gestational age, so, you know, 18-20 weeks, it's a procedure that is what it is, you know, where we have to place something in the cervix to help dilate the cervix, and then we use surgical tools to break the bag of water and remove the contents of the uterus. And it is, you know, it's not like a vaginal birth where everything is delivered at once. So it is not, those more advanced ones are not, you know, I guess I would say the most benign in terms of what it appears like. Those are also the vast minority, less, 1.3%, I think is the statistic. of terminations happen after 16 or 17 weeks. So we are talking about the vast minority. And while those pictures can be shocking, I mean, I think, could we also show a video of the pregnant person who was forced to birth their child and watch them die without any intervention because nothing is going to help them? Or, you know, let's say, for example, you know, a situation where their brain hasn't developed, or their lungs, and watching a child basically, you know, a baby drown, gasping for air. I mean, to me, that's pretty damn graphic too, but that's the beauty of this movement, is that they choose what they decide to shock you with. And never are they showing the pictures of what it looks like when you do an aspiration at 6 weeks and you can't even barely see anything because that's what it looks like, you know, and but that doesn't help their narrative, so they don't show that. But I know exactly those pictures because I went to Catholic school too, and I actually did a report on abortion and why it was wrong. And I remember looking at those pictures and putting them into my report. And I just wish I had it now so I could, like, redo it and be like, here's the other side you left out, Jen. It's all there, you know, it's their agenda, right? They want to shock you. But I mean, come and do the vaginal birth with me for the person who was raped by her uncle and tell me that's not, maybe, if not more shocking and more heinous, but, you know, it doesn't help their narrative.
Something that I've heard quite frequently from those who are part of the pro-life mm-hmm. movement is that the majority of abortions performed are not medically necessary. I'd like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting statement, right? Because who gets to decide what is medically necessary? Like, is there an abortion Olympics where you have to, like, state your case and you have to like get enough stars or like wow the judges about how this impacts your life. Like, do we ask men who are suffering from erectile dysfunction if they're like how medically necessary their orgasm and Viagra is? We don't, because again, this is about control. And if you don't believe that this abortion, if you are pregnant, is not medically necessary for you, then awesome and don't have one. But I mean, I don't think that it should be an abortion Olympics. And while what I did highlight at the March for Reproductive Rights, you know, I highlighted extreme cases, I think it's very important to put out there that any abortion that a person wants is medically relevant to them, because it's their body that you would then say, sorry, that's not enough. You need to now go through pregnancy, like deal with it, like too bad. When do we ever tell people in any other situation that we are deciding how necessary or not something is? You know, it's just, it's a really strange juxtaposition, because you extrapolate that to, okay, well, if I have a cousin who needs a kidney transplant and I'm a match and I choose not to do it, like, should I be forced to do that too? Because that's medically necessary and that's pro-life versus this. It's just a weird suggestion. And if we are going to say that only abortions that are quote unquote good enough are the ones in rape and incest or the ones where there's fetal anomalies, like, you're saying that to other people that, well, I know that it, medically it's not a big deal, but I know you don't have any money to feed your baby and you're going to end up homeless, but yeah, you know, not medically necessary. Sorry, you can't have one. It's just really strange. And it puts us, it defines us solely, it treats us as a vessel, and that's all we're good for. We're like the candy wrapper, the baby's the candy. And once the candy's out, we don't care, we throw the wrapper away. It's a really strange way. Like, you have to prove that your abortion is, it's quote unquote necessary enough.
No, I think a lot of people, I think that was very a consistent sentiment mm-hmm. that was said at the march, or expressed at the mm-hmm. march, of mm-hmm. not being a vessel and having to prove. Like, there are a lot of different stories about different kinds of abortions. Yeah. And I'm curious, right. You know, again, flip-flopping between, you know, mm-hmm. speaking to someone who's pro-choice, pro-life, mm-hmm. when I'm talking to someone who's pro-life, they'll often say, well, those extreme cases are rare and they're used quite often by people like mm-hmm. myself, people who are part of the media, to push an agenda, and that doctors are in large part of that agenda because they mm-hmm. are pro-choice.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to that? Because it's there are so many variables to this, and it just seems like there's just such, we're at politically in society, we're at such extreme odds of the situation. Mm-hmm. And anyway, yeah, your thoughts, I would appreciate on that.
Yeah. So I hear that a lot. I hear that they say, well, only, you know, abortions that are for rape and incest are like less than 1% of all abortions. So why are you making that so important? And I would say, touche, my friend. Why are you making such a big deal out of what you call late term abortions, of which, by the way, there's no medical definition? Of which are 1.3% of all abortions or less. So I could say the same thing. The difference with my statistic is that my statistic, I guarantee you, is not correct, because the vast majority of sexual assault survivors are not reporting them. Why? Because they have been told by society that once you do, it's a blame game, and there's the slut shaming, and there's all these things that we're seeing, right? When we see the anti-choice movement, how they treat people who are, you know, pro-choice or trying to get an abortion at a clinic. So they don't speak up. So that, I guarantee you, is underreported. And I would also say, once again, if you don't agree with it, then don't have one. But why would you then force an abortion or force somebody to carry something to term when they've been assaulted? And I think that is just one example. So to say that that's the only reason that we, or the only thing that we talk about when it comes to access to abortion. No, I mean, the vast majority, I think it's even more important that we understand that it needs to be all abortions. You don't need to have some sob story in order to have access to one. Because when we do that, we are then saying that some abortions are worth it or worthwhile and some aren't. And that's not the case.
Right, somebody somehow merit-based.
Doesn't want to be? Exactly. Then they get to decide for themselves.
Is there anything mm-hmm. that you're seeing that the media is not representing well, or that they're leaving out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, at least what I don't hear a lot of, and maybe it's out there, but I think it's really important to get more facts out there about when abortions are happening and you know, there's this idea that like people just wake up one day and they're like, well, like, I'm pregnant, but I guess I'll get an abortion. No, these are, you know, these are well thought out decisions. And about 50, 51% of people who become pregnant and get an abortion, they were on birth control. I think it's really important to highlight that people are not using abortion as birth control, that birth control isn't perfect. And I think that's just important, because otherwise it just makes people who get abortions seem like these irresponsible, you know, characters who can't make a decision, and they absolutely can. And I just think it's really important that they continue to highlight the statistics that 90% of abortions happen before 13 weeks, and that total, even two-thirds are in the first 9 weeks of pregnancy. So you will see the far side of the right that says, no, these late-term abortions and whatever that means. No, the vast majority of these are happening early. And I think that I also would like to see the media discuss this more as a human rights issue, because the people who are the most affected are the lower socioeconomic status, younger people, and people who do not have good access to healthcare, who live in rural areas, BIPOC communities. So they are the ones being hit the most, and that's not fair. And they're the same communities that have higher morbidity and mortality rates, the same communities that don't have access to good health insurance or contraception. So this abortion rights is one aspect of a larger reproductive rights movement. And I think part of the reason the media isn't portraying it as much as that is because we need to be more vocal on that. And so I'm hoping to see us change that message a little bit more.
If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Row on the Rocks on KBOFM, a podcast about barriers to abortion access here in Oregon. I've been speaking with Portland OBGYN, Dr. Jennifer Lincoln, about the medical impact of these abortion barriers and bans and the different kinds of abortion procedures. Next up, I'm speaking with Amy Vaught, a board member of the Oregon Women X Campaign School, an organization started in 1972 by the Oregon Women's Caucus to educate activists, political candidates, and elected officials on how to be advocates of reproductive justice rights and both keep and strengthen those rights here in Oregon. In my conversation with Amy Vaught, she explains that just because an abortion is legal does not make it accessible for everyone, even here in Oregon. Now here's more with my conversation with Amy Vaught. What's interesting is that the school started, it originated right before Roe, and then it looks like it really got going in 79, so when Roe was still new. But to this point, Oregon has no restrictions on abortion. Can you talk about why the school, given that there's still obviously barriers for many folks in Oregon, mm-hmm. but given that there is such an advantage to folks who do want that access, or at least believe in that access, why is it so important to continue this school and to get people to understand what it means to be a reproductive justice advocate?
Of course. I believe it's essential to continue to train people in this fight, because the only reason Oregon is the state with no abortion restrictions, the only way that happens and the only way it will stay that way is if people continue to show up and fight. It's difficult realizing that nearly every legislative session here in Oregon, there's multiple bills introduced. Granted, they don't usually make it to hearings and committees, but there's bills introduced every session trying to ban or highly limit access to abortion here in Oregon. It's constant. The attempts to overturn Roe, to limit access here and still find ways to claim it's legal, that never stops. Absolutely never stops. And there's a strong and vocal opposition to abortion access and reproductive justice here in Oregon. And if we are quiet, if we are silent, they very much enjoy filling the space and being very, very loud. And to protect Oregon the way it is, to stay this state of reproductive freedom, that means constantly and carefully training new leaders all across the experience spectrum so that we can preserve this legacy for people who come next.
That's really interesting. And like you said, that's something I've been aware of for some time now. You're right. And obviously you would know even better, there's constant legislation being pushed through to limit or remove abortion in Oregon. Do you see that as a vulnerability in Oregon at any point in time in the future in terms of seats being taken over by folks who are anti-abortion in Oregon?
There's always a danger of seats going to people who both vocally oppose abortion. Personally, I think it's more insidious and more terrifying, the people who find ways to twist the language to make it sound completely pro-choice while also attempting to take that choice. That to me is more dangerous. And so not only is it important that we have reproductive justice advocates, staffers, candidates, politicians, just everyday human beings in basically every room that they can, we're not going to hear the new coded language. We're not going to see that new bill. And maybe you are a pro-choice candidate, but if you don't maybe know the new keywords, it's really easy to vote on a bill without knowing the entirety of what got snuck in between the lines. And so training people to recognize other terms, training people just to keep an eye on trends, things like that, there's a sort of awareness that we're training people to have that I think is essential to maintaining Oregon the way it is, because it is very easy to imagine us joining every other state and somehow limiting the access to abortion. And that's terrifying to me. It breaks my heart, frankly. And to make sure that doesn't happen, that means constantly training people. That means asking those people that we've trained to come back and tell us if what they learned actually helped them in the field. We want that feedback, because we want every time that somebody comes in, gets this training, that they can be confident that they have the messaging, that they have the tools.